Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive. Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. Here's a recording I've titled, How to Get the Money You Need Fast for Your Business When the Bank Says No. If you're a small or medium-sized company requiring financing for growth, acquisition, or turnaround, this interview with Barry will open your eyes to some new possibilities. In this interview, you'll hear how Barry has carved the special niche in the financial industry. While many banks will not or cannot help a business to grow by assisting in the acquisition of another company or assisting in the turnaround of a business who is experiencing financial difficulty due to some circumstances, these banks will send them to Barry and his team. In this interview, Barry gives an in-depth explanation of each of their services along with example case studies of successes where they acted as the intermediary to the process. Their ability to structure and arrange financing that facilitates the achievement of their clients' goals has created strong relationships within the financing community. This allows Barry to deal directly with the decision makers of lending institutions. This is a fascinating new approach that will broaden your knowledge of the requirements necessary to engage a person with connections like Barry to help you achieve your desired personal growth. The bottom line is this: if you need money for your business and you've been turned down by banks and other traditional lending avenues, you need to hear this recording. Barry is one-stop shopping to help you get the money you need to facilitate acquisition or to facilitate capital to grow your enterprise. Enjoy. What is it that you offer that others don't offer, and what are some of the services that you provide?
Basically, has been in business since 1986, specifically representing small to medium-sized companies, which we define as companies with revenues of about $5 to $10 million on the low end to about $100-$150 million on the top end.
And these are gross sales?
Yes, gross sales, gross revenues. We've been representing these companies primarily to facilitate their working capital needs for growth, turnaround, and acquisition. Basically, we are involved in arranging senior secured working capital lines of credit. These are revolving lines of credit typically secured by accounts receivable and inventory, as well as term debt secured typically by fixed assets, such as the machinery and equipment, and to a certain extent, real estate. The primary reason companies use us is usually when their existing lender or prospective lender says, no, we don't want to finance your growth, no, we don't want to finance your turnaround, or no, we don't want to finance your acquisition. That's typically when companies come to us. Since 1986, so we just recently completed our 106th financing. That's out of about 1,214 that we've taken on, so we have a very high success rate.
What are some of the reasons a bank will turn someone down that they're not willing to risk that you're willing to do? How are you able to get around the problems that the banks aren't willing to risk on?
Typically, banks are concerned with maybe the company's too highly leveraged, maybe the company is in an industry that they don't feel comfortable in or don't have an expertise in, maybe the prospective borrower is not as profitable as they require, so there's a variety of reasons.
Are the banks somewhat rigid looking at they have to meet these certain criteria across the board, or it's just no deal?
Typically, the banks are more conservative. They're looking for more stable companies that are not highly leveraged, that have consistent profitability, that don't experience a lot of bumps in the road. Getting back to your other question a moment ago, why do companies use us? There's really two keys to our success. One, the relationships we have with lenders across the country. These are typically asset-based lending institutions, which are either independent, they're either subsidiaries of major banks, finance or insurance companies, and industrials.
What's an asset lender?
Asset-based lender is a lender that's typically lending against the receivables and inventory. They're looking at that as the source of repayment for the loan, as opposed to banks, which are typically more balance sheet and cash flow oriented.
So these lenders are lending based mainly on receivables coming in and secured assets of the company.
Right, typically receivables and inventory.
Do they lend on a one-to-one basis, or what's their ratio?
You know, they'll advance up to 85% of the receivables, and typically they'll advance up to 50% of the inventory.
And how does this come into play and differentiate from factoring?
Factoring is where a company's actually selling their invoices on a recourse basis. Asset-based lending is you create basically a pool of receivables that you're borrowing against, and it's kind of done on a bulk gross basis as opposed to an individual invoice-by-invoice basis.
So it's pretty secured lending by the time you do your due diligence.
Correct. And, you know, most companies, including Fortune 1000 companies, are borrowing from asset-based lenders, so it's a very established form of lending. So basically the reason companies use us is our relationships with the asset-based lenders around the country. Our relationships are typically with the president or EVP or senior VP of those lending organizations, and therefore these are the senior decision makers. Most borrowers, you know, typically do not have access to the key decision makers.
And how is it that you have access to them? How did you establish these relationships? Where did this all start, and does that give you some kind of edge on other lending institutions?
Yeah, we've been doing this since 1986, and prior to that, in our firm, we were direct asset-based lenders. So these are relationships that we've developed over the years. A lot of these lenders have our existing clients in their portfolio. So when we get retained by a company, our reputation's on the line every time we do a financing. So we're really credentializing the borrower based on our track record.
So before this, you were one of the asset-based lenders. So that's how you got the expertise in knowing how to do it.
Exactly. And everybody in our firm were typically either CPAs or ex-lenders. The second thing that has allowed us to be successful is we do a very detailed underwriting of every transaction. And by that, I mean we basically put together a book that is in a format that the lenders are used to seeing, an analysis that is critical to them, whereby we are doing a complete analysis of the company's not only collateral, but also their financial condition, projections, so forth and so on. Within the firm here, we have a team of underwriters that do that.
Let's say I'm one of these companies looking for financing, and let's say I'm local in L.A. near where you are, and your team is going to come out on my location and sit with me and go through all the numbers?
All the numbers, and we'll put together a book that is really geared to the senior lender that it's going to go to.
So how does this differentiate from executive summary and business plan?
It's more focused on collateral and credit. You know, the lenders really aren't concerned that you're selling a product into a market that's a $1 billion-a-year market.
They just want to know they're covered.
Mm-hmm.
And how long is this book, and what's in it? What's important for your team to put together in this?
The background on the company, the management, and then the critical part are what's the collateral, how does it perform, such as how quick do the receivables turn, are there any major customer concentrations, things like that, inventory, how much of it is finished goods versus raw materials or work in process, and then a complete analysis of the financial performance of the company. If they've lost money, what are they doing to turn it around? If they are profitable, are those profits real? A complete analysis of that, instead of format that these senior lenders are used to seeing. The purpose of the book is really to do the lender's homework for them, so it's easier for them to get to make a decision.
You're presenting them a package there.
Exactly.
How long is it?
Depending on the deal and the size of the deal and complexity, it'll run anywhere from 10 to 20 pages. Geared towards the president or EVP of the lending organization to be able to read this in about 20 minutes or so.
So he's looking at lots of these.
Yeah, and usually not as well prepared as ours. But reading our book takes about 20 minutes. After that period of time, they can pretty much make a decision that this is a deal we want to go forward with.
Does that give you an edge because you know how to put these books together right?
That's extremely important. And we see the most CEOs and CFOs, they're not in the business of raising capital all day long. They're in the business of trying to run their companies, which is a big enough challenge. And trying to find money for a company can be a full-time job, and that's the responsibility that we take off their shoulders is really going out and finding the capital. And we have clients all over the country. We do lenders on a nationwide basis. And if you're sitting in Denver, you may not have access to lenders back east. They may not know who you are and so forth.
Let me ask you this. Can you give me two or three components in that book that you're able to put in that most other prospectuses would fall short on, and how that gives you an edge?
Sure. Probably the critical one is the collateral analysis. really analyzing how the receivables perform, turnover, dilution, concentration, aging, inventory, how does it perform? And then also we do what's probably one of the most critical pieces in the whole deal or the whole write-up is what's called the loan source and use section, which basically takes the proceeds from the collateral pool, what the receivables will yield at 85% advance rate, the inventory, to get your total proceeds, what you're using those proceeds for, usually pay off an existing lender, usually bring accounts payable current, fees and so forth, and really determine if there's excess availability, which is a very critical part of the analysis, because if there's no excess availability, then typically a lender's not going to lend into the deal because they're not providing any value and actually could be lending into a deal that could be challenged if the company ever filed bankruptcy. So there's various issues regarding why availability is so critical. And then also we do what is known as a borrowing-based projection, which is really what the lenders are focused on, seeing how much the collateral is going to grow, turn, and perform, and therefore how much they're really going to be borrowing over the next 12 to 24 months.
Now, how much time does it take to put one of these things together, the book?
Typically takes about a week on average, not a full 40 hours. A lot of it's stop and go, but you need additional information from the company and so forth. But it takes about a week.
When you bring your team into these companies, do you get in there and sometimes find that their books are all screwed up? And so do you aid in getting that together? Or is it just if they're so messed up and let's say they're not keeping good records and there's missing stuff, what do? Simply ditch it?
What we would do in that case is refer in a CFO for rent to help them get their books and records in order and then send in an outsourced due diligence auditor, something that the lenders would typically use to come in and do their due diligence audit. We'll send them in ahead of time to see if the books are really auditable, and if so, then we will feel comfortable that now we can go back to the market and present the deal to the lenders.
All right, let's go a step before this book's put together. How is someone going to get to you to where you make a decision to even invest the time and effort in putting a team together to come into the business and actually put this book together? What are they going to need to get your attention to get to that point? What are you looking for, ideally?
We're looking for a company that needs to borrow a minimum of $1 million, typically. And then we will go out and meet with them, and they will provide us with their last 2 to 3 years' worth of year-end financial statements, an interim financial statement, receivable and payable agings, a projection if they prepared one. We will basically take a look at that, do our analysis, and then if we feel comfortable, then we will issue them an engagement agreement letter, basically specifying what we think the terms and conditions of the line of credit are going to look like. They'll talk about our retainer and success fee. At that point, if they feel comfortable and they agree with what we say, then we sign our agreement, get our retainer check, and then we start going to work. Before we ask anybody for any money, we will do our own due diligence on our own dime.
You have your traditional lenders, all the banks and stuff, but how many companies are there like yours that are as qualified as yours? Are you a unique bird in the marketplace?
We're fairly unique. There's a lot of investment banking firms that are more focused on sell-side M&A transactions.
What is that?
No mergers and acquisitions.
All right, so you're not a merger and acquisition company.
We will do it. It's not our primary focus. Our primary focus is representing buyers who want to acquire companies and arranging the capital. So we're more buy side, and then companies that need revolving lines of credit or term debt financings to facilitate growth, turnaround, or acquisition.
Is there anything you enjoy working with most, or does it all come down to whether you can get the money?
We have clients in a variety of industries, from low-tech to high-tech to bleeding-edge technology companies.
Let's get into some examples, because illustrating some examples helps me understand the whole process. Can you talk about some of your most recent financing?
Yeah.
Let's talk about one and look into it a little bit more detail.
Yeah, we had a client based in Texas who exports meat and sugar to Mexico.
Had you even initially hear about them, or have they contacted you?
Typically, companies come to us. They're typically referred by their attorneys or accountants or existing, you know, bankers or consultants.
All right, so this company is exporter of meat and sugar products to Mexico.
Correct. And so all of their receivables are due from Mexican companies, which is problematic for most lenders here in the United States. They are foreign receivables, and we were able to mitigate that by putting in place an insurance policy that basically insured the collectability of those foreign receivables.
Okay, so there's a company that will insure foreign receivables.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. It insure you or them?
The actual Mexican companies. It's credit insurance.
Credit insurance.
Mm-hmm.
How big of a company was this?
This year they'll do about, I'd say about $150 million in sales.
All right. So what was their situation that brought them to you? They needed capital?
They needed an increase in their working capital line of credit to support the growth in sales. And their existing lender would not increase their credit facility. Small bank based in Texas, they just didn't have the capacity.
Did they seek out additional financing? Do you know?
Yeah, that's how they got to us.
Okay.
So we did an accounts receivable line of credit as well as an inventory line of credit.
So you were able to insure the receivables. What else made this look like a good deal for you?
Excellent management team. Company's been doubling sales every year. They were profitable.
Let's talk about a management team. When you're looking at one of these, what do you need to see in a management team? What makes an excellent management team for you guys to move on with something?
First and foremost is integrity.
How do you do the due diligence on that?
Typically, we're referred in by one of their trusted advisors, so they're pretty well credentialized by the referral source. And after you meet with them, there's the things that we've learned over the years, certain questions to ask and see how they respond.
Give me a couple of them.
If it's a company that's in a turnaround, you kind of examine their lifestyle. They cut back their lifestyle, or are they still draining their company? Things like that.
I see. Lifestyle meaning, are they taking a bunch of money out of the business?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're looking at management, you want to look at the person.
Exactly.
Do you want to look at how long they've been there?
Mm-hmm. Their length of time, their expertise in their industry.
What happens if you see that maybe the management team may be moving on or breaking up in the near future? Is that a big risk?
It can be, and it has to be addressed. Maybe at that point we would recommend that they bring in a new key executive to fill the position that's being vacated.
What happens if there's a crisis? Let's say you've got these revolving credits for this meat and sugar exporter, and let's say there's problems going on. Let's say the main management guy has a heart attack and dies. Do you guys assist in putting out fires and keeping everything good? Is that part of the service?
Well, we will. That's post-financing. Typically, most of the companies we're lending into or taking on as clients, they have pretty good management teams. So let's say the CEO dies, and that's obviously a material adverse change in the business, but there's usually a management team and people there that can keep the business running until a new CEO is found or the business is sold or whatever. Maybe the resolution for that.
All right, let's talk about another example. You've got here $3.7 million revolving credit facility and term loan for a family-owned specialty printing company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where are they out of?
Here in Los Angeles.
What kind of volume are they doing?
$5-6 million a year.
It's a printing company. The margins don't sound like they could be that spectacular. So
it's kind of been a business for about 40 years. Grandfather had founded the company, and it's multi-generational, so it's the father and his son and daughter running the company presently. And that business has gone through a lot of changes, and they've made a big capital investment in a big piece of equipment that was not performing right and caused them to lose money, start stretching their payables. And what we did there is we did two things. They were not financing their receivables, so we put in a line of credit to basically facilitate their working capital on a short-term basis. And then we refinanced their equipment loan, which was with the SBA. The equipment loan was secured by the building, which had a lot of equity in it. So we were able to structure a term loan where we were able to increase the amortization period from 10 years to 20 years, thereby improving their cash flow.
They were somewhat in trouble for growing. You come in as a turnaround expert, but you're looking at all their existing loans and financing, and with your expertise, you're able to move things around, get better financing, bring more cash, and that's your expertise in making it work, right?
Exactly.
That sounds pretty good.
A lot of value added, whether it's from a growth situation or a turnaround, really helping them position, get ready for the financing, and try and take care of the issues and come up with a solution to whatever issues we find before we start going to the lending community. And one thing I should point out is we typically only send books to about 3 to 5 lenders. So we know pretty much for each deal that we take on who the 3 to 5 most likely lenders are for that company based on that company's size, borrowing requirements, size, and credit and collateral characteristics.
I see. So you know what lenders are looking for, and you'll match up your books
exactly.
to those.
Exactly.
And some lenders like different deals better than others, right?
Right. Some will only do deals $10 million above. Some will only do deals $1 million to $5 million. So there's a lot of variation there.
Let's talk about this one. $6 million in senior debt and equity financing for the acquisition of a branded consumer products company.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this one.
This is a deal where a very seasoned consumer brand product executive wanted to acquire a specialty company that basically provided to the cosmetics industry.
So it was an acquisition.
Acquisition. And they were selling their product primarily to the major retailers, Walmart, Target, as well as the drugstore and grocery store chains.
The company they were acquiring or their existing company?
The company they were acquiring.
Okay.
The Target company. And so our client is putting up a certain amount of her own capital, and we we went out and raised equity capital as well as senior debt. But besides doing revolving lines of credit, we also will raise subordinated debt and or private equity.
Subordinated debt and private equity?
Right.
What is subordinated debt?
Subordinated debt is sometimes known as mezzanine capital, and basically, if you look at the capital structure of a company, you have senior debt, which usually has a claim on all the assets, and then you have equity. Mezzanine debt comes in between there, where basically it performs like debt, but has the characteristics of equity. They're unsecured. They typically get an interest rate for the money, but they also usually get a warrant to purchase equity in the company.
When you go into these businesses and you bring your team in, is one of the hardest parts really evaluating what the business is worth?
On an acquisition, yes, because the seller has one opinion what his business is worth, and the buyer may or may not have a good idea of what the business is truly worth. And one of the people in our staff is a CVA, which is a certified valuation analyst. So we do a lot of business valuations. So we can pretty much determine what a business is worth and what a fair range is to pay for a business.
In your experience, what you come up with, what it's worth, and what the owner thinks it's worth, is there usually a difference there, or are they pretty open to your analysis?
What we are doing is validating whether the seller is being reasonable. And that's the main goal, determine the range of value for the business. And if that seller is within that range, then it's probably a fair transaction. In this particular case, where we thought the business was worth $6 million and the sellers really thought it was worth $9 million, that's a pretty big gap. Hard to justify the $9
million. Do you go look at competing businesses in the marketplace around the country and look at, is that like you evaluate a house in a way?
Exactly. You do public market comps.
You've provided me a brief list of some common issues facing buyers of companies. Let's go through some of these and expand on these. Number one, providing enough time to develop a relationship with the seller. Explain what this was. Put it in perspective here.
Sure. If somebody's acquiring a company, I think it's important to have a successful outcome. The buyer and the seller, you have to develop a good relationship where they trust each other, they can communicate with each other, be open with each other, and I think that helps facilitate a transaction. You don't want it to be adversarial, and you want the seller to be enrolled in the process.
When you're talking about a buyer and seller, for example, if I have a multi-million dollar business and I wanted to sell it and I had a potential buyer, could you help me facilitate that whole deal?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so when you're talking about enough time for the buyer and seller to establish a relationship, that's going to be myself and the buyer, correct?
Correct.
And you're going to be the intermediary to help do all the services to make this deal work.
Exactly. Raise the capital, structure the deal, and foster the relationship through the due diligence phase.
Okay, that's great. Number two, which professionals to hire? Examples, investment bankers, attorneys, CPAs. Put this in perspective for me.
Yeah, a lot of buyers, when they go to acquire a company, especially entrepreneurs, what typically happens is they'll meet with the seller and they negotiate a deal, and then they bring in the professionals. Well, by the time they bring in the professionals, it's hard to undo some of the mistakes they may have made. So it's always good to get your team together in the beginning of the process as opposed to into the middle of the process.
Okay. So if I was a buyer and I'm looking for companies, could you give me just some of your personal advice, some tips on the order of how I should do things? Let's say I know I want to buy a multi-million dollar business, okay, and I'm going to use you to help me put this deal together as far as financing. And I'm out there, I'm looking at businesses, I'm contacting owners of multi-million dollar businesses. They're interested in selling. First, let me bring this up. Let's say if I represent myself that I can pay all cash, let's say someone's interested in selling the business. Do you do seller financing, or are you focusing on paying them out with the financing that you get, paying the seller out all at once?
It can be a combination of both. I mean, sometimes what we'll do is if the seller's asking for X and the buyer says we can only finance Y, we'll get the seller to basically carry the difference back in a subordinated note. There's various ways to handle that.
But are there some cases where you can pay him what he wants?
Absolutely.
All right, so give me an order of what I should do. I'm contacting these sellers. They're raising their hand. They're interested. Their books are open. What's the first thing I should do if I'm really serious about this?
First thing is basically once you've identified a target and have come to at least some verbal understanding with the seller as to what the purchase price is going to be.
Do I want to tie it up with a letter of intent?
Exactly. And make sure that at that point have your attorney, who has expertise in doing M&A transactions, put together a non-binding letter of intent, which gives you a certain period of exclusivity to do due diligence, which during that time the seller cannot go out and shop.
What's a typical time period? What do you recommend?
Usually 90 to 120 days.
So tie it up for 90 or 100 days so I can do my due diligence.
Correct.
And it's non-binding. Does any money trade hands?
Sometimes, you know, you'll put up a good faith deposit.
When you say non-binding agreement, that means non-binding, meaning I'm not committing to buying anything.
Right. It's, you know, subject to financing, subject to due diligence. At some point during the process, you will enter into a formal purchase and sale agreement.
Right. So tie it up with the due diligence. Then, once that's done, do I start putting my team together?
Once you've done the non-binding letter of intent at that point, it's important to have your accountants and investment bankers start getting involved in the process, helping structure the due diligence at the same time.
Who should be on my team? What kind of attorney? Business attorney?
Yeah, a corporate securities attorney.
All right, corporate securities attorney, and who else?
Expertise in secured lending and M&A transactions. A CPA, preferably a well-respected regional firm, and then an investment banker to help value the deal and raise the capital.
And so what do? I call each of them, I explain what I'm doing, and I say...
One of them said, so the potential buyer called me, says, could you recommend an attorney and CPA? I would put the team together for them.
Okay, you could do that service, so you could do it all at once.
Sure.
Let's say I did call you, and what are you going to charge me to get going on this? Let's say I've got it tied up for 90 days with a letter of intent. Everything looks good, at least on my end. I'm ready to put my team together. What are you going to need from me to get going?
We typically work on a retainer and success fee basis, and our retainers will range anywhere from... A lot of it depends upon the size and complexity of the deal. Typically, our retainers are in the $10,000 to $15,000 range.
How much service is that going to get me?
Quite a lot.
All right, what is that going to do for me?
It's going to get the book put together, the valuation of the business. If this is an acquisition, if it's not an acquisition, really getting the book put together.
Your team will meet with the seller?
Sure.
Okay.
The seller most likely will have an investment banker representing them and help negotiate the letter of intent. Validate the purchase price, then go out and raise the capital, at which time, once the capital is raised and the deal closes, you know, we get a success fee, which will be anywhere from 1% to 5% of the amount of capital raised.
All right. So the retainer, it's an important thing for you to screen and separate the really serious people from
that. Exactly. It shows commitment.
All right. Very good. Number three, getting emotionally caught up in the auction process. What's this mean?
A lot of times a seller will hire an investment banker to sell their business, and what will happen is they will basically hold an auction. They'll have three companies bidding, five companies, 10 companies, and a lot of times buyers will get emotionally caught up in trying to buy the company, and just want to make sure you don't overpay.
So this is advice if you're buying, not to get caught up in the emotion. So a lot of sellers will hire an investment banker?
Yeah, if they're smart.
And that's a good way if you want to sell your business?
Yeah, because it's always better to have somebody else represent you as opposed to yourself. A lot more professional, a lot less emotional.
I mean, when you're selling a house, you get a real estate agent. How does an investment banker differ from all these business brokers out there?
Business brokers are typically selling very small businesses. Investment bankers are dealing with companies with minimum revenues of $10-20 million, at least up to $1 million. So these are real substantial businesses, manufacturers, distributors.
Right, so that's the best way to go. If you want to sell your business and you're doing millions, you contact an investment banker.
Right, somebody would contact us if they wanted to sell. Yeah, we'd sit down, do the valuation, and then show up with a target list of potential buyers, both financial buyers and strategic buyers.
Right, so you're like one-stop shopping.
Yeah.
We're not even finished yet, but it sure makes life a lot easier. So I can focus on just putting the deals together.
Exactly.
Okay. Number four, establishing objective measures for pre-closing operations. Example, maintaining a minimum level of net worth, working capital, et cetera. Let's talk about this.
As the buyer, you want to make sure that the seller doesn't start taking out a lot of money and deteriorating the net worth or the working capital of the business.
And are there some agreements that put all that in place?
Yeah, that's typically in the letter.
Is that common sometimes?
We've seen it happen.
Okay, so it's establishing objective measures for pre-closing operations. So that's one of the measures, making sure the seller isn't draining the company.
Exactly.
What's another typical thing as far as objective measures?
You want to make sure that the key management is still going to be there.
Can you sometimes go in and negotiate with the management to stay on?
Yeah, there's ways to. A lot of times they'll want to stay on. They can be part of the new management or buying group.
Right. Can it sometimes spook the management that the company's being sold?
Sure. It's a very sensitive issue.
What's your expertise that alleviates the fear in the management? How do you handle that delicate subject?
Once the letter of intent has been signed with the CEO or the CFO, basically at some point shortly thereafter, you sit down with the management, lay out your vision, get them enrolled. It's the fact that although you're coming in as the new owner, that you don't envision things changing. That's why we're buying the business. This is a good job everybody's done, and here's how we're going to help you guys grow and so forth and so on.
All right, you just lay it out for them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Every deal is different, obviously, but yeah, you want to get them enrolled. as early as possible in the process.
By structuring earnouts when the parties cannot agree on price, what's an earnout?
Earnout is basically if we can't agree on the price.
Between seller and buyer.
Right, because the seller is saying, well, this business makes $1 million a year, and the buyer says, well, I've done my analysis, it's only really making $500,000. Then what you do is you structure what is known as an earnout, that if the business makes an excess of $1 million over the next 3 years, we'll give you 50% of that excess. So basically what we're doing is you're getting the seller to basically be a believer in his own business, that the business will generate what he says he's going to do. So the seller is really putting his money where his mouth is.
Okay, very good. Enrolling seller management and key employees in the process.
That's what we just talked about a moment ago.
Okay, got it. So getting them on the side of the acquisition or the sale.
Uh-huh.
Identifying cultural and integration issues. What's this about?
Basically, every organization has its own culture, and you as the buyer need to get a good handle on that culture.
Do you have a specific example we could talk about, like a situation that you dealt with where cultural issues were an issue?
Yeah, I think it's endemic in each deal. Let's say you, the buyer, have an existing company and you're acquiring another company. You may have a whole different business culture than the company you're acquiring, and how you integrate that is very, very critical. There are some studies that have been done that show amongst the Fortune 1000 that something like two-thirds of acquisitions do not meet the objectives set out at the beginning. In other words, they're not successful mergers or acquisitions. And the primary reason is they were not able to integrate the culture of the acquirer with the acquiree.
Or the philosophies of the business,
exactly.
They didn't match.
Exactly.
It's like Sears bought Land's End, and now they're complaining because they're losing all kinds of money.
Right, and the employees aren't happy because, you know, the Sears culture, which is a very bureaucratic, very entrenched, very inflexible culture compared to Land's End, which is very creative.
Great marketing company.
Yeah, but it's more free-form, more liberal culture. I mean, it's very difficult to integrate those, and that's probably why there's unhappiness on both sides.
Okay. I mean, you're out there looking for deals, aren't you? I mean, this is what you do. Where are you going to go first? If you had 100 different businesses out there to look at, what do you find are the best kind of companies? Manufacturing? Service businesses? What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of getting these deals done from each?
What you want to find as a buyer, if you're looking at acquisition opportunities, once you get past the financial, is it making money, are the sales stable or growing, does the business have some type of compelling reason to be in business? They have a competitive advantage. And you can tell that by the fact that they have good gross profit margins. They have gross profit margins of 40 or 50%. There's something that they're doing that's providing value that people in the marketplace are valuing, and they're increasing their market share. Something they're doing is compelling. If they have a gross profit margin because they're manufacturing something, their gross profit margin is only, you know, 10 or 20%, they're more likely in a commodity-oriented business, which could be good, don't get me wrong. That's going to be very sales-driven, and you have to be able to control costs in order to make that thing successful. So one of the things you have to look for is, why does this business deserve to be in business?
Your turnaround expertise, you know, you've got a lot of financing issues that give you a lot of strength in turning something around based on the assets and the real estate or what have you. How about marketing? When you're looking for companies, are you looking for under-marketed businesses? And do you have in your firm some expertise in good marketing where you see some real golden opportunities that could, with some good marketing, really rev up the sales that the existing owner just didn't have a clue about?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you'll see buyers that have that expertise. They may be buying a company where the owners are in their 60s or 70s, and they just don't have the chops to keep growing the business. And you got a guy who's a buyer who's a great marketing guy. So, yeah, I mean, there are those situations.
But that's not going to really matter to you because your bread and butter is getting the financing. You're not going to get a piece of the growth.
Correct.
So you're not really looking for that.
Not particularly. We're really more focused on getting the financing done, making sure it's a good transaction, and making sure that the buyer does not overpay and that the seller comes away feeling that he got a very fair price.
But when it comes down to it, all of these deals are going to have to be secured by equipment, real estate, some kind of assets, good solid receivables and sales.
And to the extent that there's not collateral, then that's when we would bring in subordinated debt or private equity to bridge that gap.
All right, so if there's not enough of this collateral, you can bring that in.
Correct.
How do you just bring that in? Can you explain that?
So we'd approach private equity firms and mezzanine capital firms and play the deal, do the same thing on.
But how do they protect themselves?
Because what they're looking at is the historical cash flows of the business and they assume that those cash flows will continue, and therefore the new management will be able to grow the business, increase the enterprise value. So if they're buying the business today at, let's say, $5 million, they hope in 5 years that the business is worth $15 million. And so when the company fails or gets acquired by another company in 5 years, that's how they make their money.
Let's say you put a deal together and the company grows in 5 years and then they get bought up again. Now, do you have a lot of clients who come back to you to help facilitate that?
Sure.
So you're with them, kind of like I keep using the analogy of real estate. If you're with a client and you help them buy their first home and then they sell and they move up to a bigger home, and you just stay with that client as long as they're in business.
Yeah, we're all about developing long-term relationships. So we've been in business since 1986, so we have a lot of clients that just every couple of years come back to us for various things, whether it's advice or new financing or growth capital or whatever it may be, selling their company, buying another company.
Tell me about a screw-up. I mean, everyone's got to have one. Tell me, can you give me an example of something that didn't go so good for you and the mistakes that were made and how you've now corrected that so it doesn't happen again? Just let's talk about some reality situations.
Sure. We did one of the kind of niches also that we have developed is arranging capital for specialty finance companies.
Mm-hmm.
So these are small factors and asset-based lenders that are lending to very small businesses. And so we had a client back in, I want to say, somewhere in the mid 90s, 95, 97,
mm-hmm.
that was at the time, probably one of the largest minority-owned factors in the country.
Mm-hmm.
They'd raised a lot of capital. Their portfolio was basically, you had bankers that became factors, and it's kind of a tough transition, but, you know, through our advice and working with them, they were getting it, you know, straightening out their portfolio, and they took some big write-downs. So we thought by the time we got the line of credit put in place that they had, you know, basically written off all their problems, which was, you know, a couple million dollars worth. So, you know, it was real money.
Yeah.
And so we put the line of credit in place. The board threw out the initial CEO, which was a mistake. So they had written off a lot of their problem loans. So we thought the portfolio was in very clean, very good shape by the time we put the line of credit in place. So we closed the deal in June, and lo and behold, one of the clients that they were lending to defrauded them, and literally in September, the lender was liquidating the company. So that was, you know, one of those unforeseen situations that, you know.
So whose fault was it? The due diligence on y'all's part?
No.
It's just sometimes these things happen.
They happen sometimes. So you can't. As a lender, it's very hard. You know, somebody's going to defraud you, they're going to get you.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing is, you know, catching it quick enough so, you know, it doesn't become overwhelming and you lose, you know.
So they liquidated the company and tried to salvage what they could?
Exactly.
All right. Is there more money out there for good investment deals than there are deals? I mean, you've got a good idea. How much money is out there from lenders willing to put money into good investment deals than there are deals? Are the deals the hard thing to find?
Yeah, the deals are the hard thing. There's plenty of money out there. That's not the issue. It's really good management teams and good companies. That's really what it comes down to. You know, if you have a good management team with a company that they're either running or trying to acquire, you know, that's, you know, profitable. If it hasn't been profitable, you know, they've turned it around and you can see that it's turning. You know, there's plenty of money.
If I'm the seller,
mm-hmm.
and you help me facilitate a sale to the buyer, do you guys take any kind of ownership in the business? How does that work? Does a buyer still have now all the control? Where's, you know, like you hear in, you know, venture capitalists, they own and control everything. They kick out the CEO
A lot of those situations are you know, early stage companies, which are, you know, very high risk, and they're, you know, they haven't made money. They haven't proven their business concept. That's a whole different entity.
Okay.
You know, the capital spectrum. But in a, you know, typical middle market transaction, you know, if the owner or the buyer is putting in, you know, equity of his own, and let's say he's bringing in private equity or mezzanine debt, you know, he's going to have a substantial, you know, piece of that company, either from all the way from control to, if he doesn't have control, he will have the ability to claw back to control based on performance.
What if a buyer doesn't have a lot of his own money in it? How much of his own money are you guys going to need to see that this guy has in it to do something like this?
You know, generally you want to see the buyer, if this is an acquisition as opposed to just a refinance, if it's an acquisition, you know, you want to see the buyer have at least, you know, somewhere between, you know, 10 and 30% of the purchase price.
Okay, into the business.
Right. Except that he can borrow the rest on a senior revolver, that's, you know, or term debt, that's fine, you know.
All right, so if he's got 10 to 30%, what percentage ownership is he going to have?
He can end up with 100%. Just depends how the deal is being financed.
As that company generates profits every month or every quarter, a piece of those profits go right to the investors.
Right. Correct. What happens, they get a dividend or an interest, you know, coupon.
Right.
So they're really looking, the investors are really looking for the buyer to, or the management team that's acquiring the company to, you know, basically grow the value of the company over a 3 to 5 year period, so at the end of that time they can have an exit strategy, i.e. sell to another company, go public, you know, refinance, you know, do a recapitalization, you know, whatever.
The investor, that is important for the investors.
Exactly. They need to get out of the deal in 3 to 5 years.
So what are some of the good exit strategies that they're looking to do? Is one of them going public and maybe investing in the stock? And
I say most likely, you know, try to do IPOs. Even what's really going to happen is they'll probably be sold to another company. That's probably the path of least resistance. Or they go back to...
And so they can make, so on that sale, those investors can...
get cashed out.
They get cashed out.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, the management team can go back to the capital markets and refinance out those lenders and provide them the return that they were looking for.
Mm-hmm. Why is it only a 3 to 5 year stint?
Typically, that's their investment horizon.
And then they just look for new deals.
Exactly. So they're managing a pool of capital, and they've told their limited partner investors that, you know, we will have an exit strategy, you know.
So is that all structured in the deal, that the financing is going to be for a limited amount of time?
Typically. I mean, you know, typically, yes. There's ways to handle that, but generally speaking, yes.
Okay, so when you're setting these deals up, this, the buyer needs to understand that there is going to be a 3 to 5 year, you know, there is going to be an exit strategy.
Yeah, and what happens, typically, if there's not an exit strategy, i.e. the company at 5 years doesn't sell or recapitalize, particularly what will happen is the investors have the right to put their stock back, you know, to the company, and the company has to buy it back.
Are you guys called in to help facilitate this thing?
Sometimes.
Okay. Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. I hope this interview with Barry has been helpful and has given you some new ideas to get the money you need for your business. If you'd like to be put in touch with Barry, please call me at 858-274-7851. That's 858-274-7851, and I will make a formal introduction. Thank you. There's an interview in the section of the audio recordings at Hard to Find Seminars. It's with a business buying expert. His name is Art Hamill. If you go back to my site, hardtofindseminars.com, and go to the product section, along the left side in light blue, you will see a list of topics. Look for the one that says business buying. Click on that link and you'll be taken to about 7 hours of exclusive interviews with Arthur Hamill. Arthur Hamill has purchased multi-million dollar businesses, over 200 of them in his lifetime, and he will tell you how to do the same thing. It's some fascinating content, and I wanted you to know about it.